Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 265 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Stephen Romer wrestles with a writing workshop and the surprising worldview of his young participants at a time of turbulence in his own writing life. Here he is with Memory Middle Age Maelstrom and teaching the young to write poetry.
I've just been teaching a poetry summer school at Auden's Old College in Oxford, and the experience has prompted some thoughts I should like to explore in this short talk. The summer school took place at the end of August, just before the beginning of term, so just after the long space, the abeyance in the year that is summer and the summer vacation. In my own case, it was a fairly long, studious season, in the intense heat of our new climatic conditions, which they tell us we shall have to get used to. A brief morning dip in the Loire, where the current is strong, and so it is an achievement simply to keep on a level with one's towel and belongings on the bank. A sense of marking time, or walking on the spot. There is a shady analogy to be drawn between this and the middle-aging poet, experiencing similar feelings, the old dilemmas, the ancient desires, but later. And the forlorn sense that we have learned nothing, we must do better. Whip and spur, as poor Coleridge exhorted himself on every birthday. But more than this, in an attempt to kick-start my writing again after the publication of Set Thy Love in Order, my new and selected poems, the kind of book that a wag once termed a minor tombstone on the journey of life, I initiated a daily writing regime, an hour or so every morning, a kind of catch-all of fragments, dreams, reflections, quotations heard or remembered. The repeated hot and amber days were honeyed walls. They seemed to lend a blessed sense of immobility. Almost identical July days, the pressures of term off. A chance, perhaps, to take stock. By August, the vague dread of la rentrée des classes, the black dog that haunts every French schoolchild, was haunting me too. But the strange heat lasted. I became fascinated by the thrushes on the lawn that terrified Ted Hughes in an early poem. And these in turn prompted other memories. A pigeon that perched on the birdbath, who took one sip of water and returned to immobility, prompted a poem of place and of metaphysical reflection. And also the simple thought that for once there was nowhere I would rather be. And then someone said the same pigeon on a similar urn was uncovered, fully preserved, in a fresco under the ashes at Pompeii. There was international disaster. The world was burning up, it seemed. Greece was on fire. Migrants were adrift on the Mediterranean. And then a viaduct I've driven over collapsed in Genoa. But random terror attacks soon swallowed up that event, and so on and so forth. And all this combined with inner troubles, torments, and distressing news of illness and madness. My question was, when the poetry school approached, a simple one. How could I possibly present myself with this inner maelstrom going on, out of which magma I had in fact managed to spring some self-standing poems? How could I appear all neat and groomed and coherent before a group of bright young adults and make sense? How could I suddenly stand aside from the maelstrom into which the summer had allowed me to enter and talk about it? How could I be the rational curator of my own inner chaos? I believe this applies to anyone who professes to teach anything at all. In the event, I think if we're honest, we usually get by, if the chaos be not too great, as we always do, by reaching for familiar texts, past notes, last year's course, the safety of the prescribed syllabus. For the RLF tutor, we can brush up on the rules of grammar, the MLA writing guide, the copious online pages of examples and guidance at our disposal. But teaching the young to write poetry, seems to be a task of a different magnitude, and a different order of peril is involved. Could I in all honesty lead them to the banks of that river, with its hidden but dangerous current, and ask them to step into it? This is not how it happens, naturally. Creative writing is by now a long-established and prestigious fixture on the university syllabus in the US and the UK, even if Oxbridge remains recalcitrant. It is even, alas, I am tempted to say, catching on in France, so long the purveyor of the kind of de haut en bas, or top-down pedagogy inimical to the atmosphere of trust and egalitarianism and exchange required in a writing workshop. Alas, because a part of me admires the French for resisting, and I like to think of somewhere holding out against the excesses of a kind of sentimental, but in fact tyrannical entitlement, which decrees that anyone could have a go, or even that anyone can call themselves a poet, if they go to a cosy, unconditionally supportive workshop. No one loses, and everybody gets copious applause. On my way back to the UK, in the murk of the Channel and in service stations, I noted down ideas and quotations, the ones that by now come so readily to hand, on the back of an envelope. For some weeks I had pondered in odd moments what poems I should show them. The opening evening of the school was held on a lawn in a magnificent hortus conclusus with Auden's cottage just over the wall, so called because this was where the old poet lodged during his last, alas, unhappy residence at the college. And when we were gathered in a room for the welcoming remarks, the school's director informed us that the great prosodist would climb through these very windows in his bedroom slippers and shuffle off to evensong. So no pressure. The universal mantra was then uttered to the assembled group, universal in any case amongst the poet come professors of creative writing I know. We cannot make you into poets, but we can perhaps make you better readers. We can set you exercises and teach certain formal elements, and we can show you some poems we like and explain why we think they are good. Not exactly pithy. Some of the more clamorous American brochures, notwithstanding, guarantees of poetic success or publication are not made. The turmoil still in my head, standing the next morning in front of my first group of hopefuls, like Lucky Jim before his lecture, I wondered what noises might proceed from my mouth. I had taken the precaution of writing in broad marker pen on the flip chart, more than usual emotion combined with more than usual order. This phrase from Coleridge, taken from his description of the poet described in ideal perfection in the Biographia, I keep with me everywhere, like a polished pebble in my pocket. Underneath that, Ezra Pound's prose is the right words in the right order, poetry is the best words in the best order. And then I ask of them to metamorphose into a mythical creature, courtesy of Pound again. Poetry is a centaur. The thinking, word-arranging, clarifying faculty must move and leap with the energizing, sentient, musical faculties. And then Joseph Brodsky's pithy, the spirit, seeking flesh, finds words. So if all else fails, throw out a few quotations, and then, departing from the flip chart, dazzle them with a touch of linguistics. Roman Jakobson's two axes, the paradigm and the syntagm. And then a little German Latin borrowed from Basil Bunting, dichten equals condensare. And the winning first line of Marianne Moore's poetry, I too dislike it, to tickle them. Then startle them, if you're lucky, with Paul Valéry's deliberately mechanistic and unromantic formulae, poetry is a machine for soliciting the larynx, stroke, to have the voice repeat, stroke, to create the poetic emotion in the reader. To placate the maelstrom within, there was above all Eliot's famous definition of the poetic sensibility, which, when it is fully equipped for its work, is constantly amalgamating disparate experiences, and combines the events of falling in love and reading Spinoza, with the sound of the typewriter and the smell of cooking. And these apparently disparate things form new wholes. In the event, it was this stress on elements combining, fused by the imagination, Coleridge again, which seemed most to approach what it was that I wanted to impress upon them from the outset, namely that the source of a poem worthy of the name, that is not mere attitude or propaganda or statement, must forever be various and often of profoundly differing elements, not in the sense merely of the image, the ruddy moon leans over a hedge like a red-faced farmer, where the simile link is explicit, but the metaphorically fused, the old star-eaten blanket of the sky, or the frost performs its secret ministry. But I couldn't spend the first hour simply spouting bon mots and possibly useful recipes. I notice also in passing that my sources reflect my generation and the literary tastes and auctoritas preferred by my own teachers, and had a certain gender bias, if you're to go down that avenue. Actually, I feel I must some way, if only because of the 15 students on the course, only 2 were men. Meanwhile, my class was waiting and expecting to write. My opening remarks were so much throat-clearing, though not to me. And they expected an exercise, perhaps, or what they called a prompt. The ready use of this term proved to me what I somewhat dreaded, that some, if not all, of my students were more experienced than I in the protocols of the creative writing class. I had a prompt ready to hand, of course, and I felt it could not fail, and therein lay my error. Basically, with the help of some tiny poems by Mark Ford and Paul Muldoon's early poem Cuba, the gist of the exercise was to write some lines, not more than 10, that followed a template of the kind, I was doing stroke thinking X when the news came through that Y, etc., i.e. when JFK or Bobby Kennedy for that matter was shot, or when Margaret Thatcher resigned, or when Princess Diana, etc., or when the Twin Towers came down, the perhaps too obvious idea being to yoke together in this way the personal and the public realms. Part of my strategy to trigger the mysterious business of combination. To my surprise, they found it hard to pick out a particular event. And this enabled me to discover one difference between these millennials, born around the turn of the century, these 21st century children, for whom not only was the 20th century the past, they had never set foot in it. They have never known a world without the internet, or without 24/7 breaking news. And it may be that with drama so continuously succeeding drama, they all blend into one. I thought they might say 9/11, but of course they were on average only 2 or 3 years old at the time, and too young also for London 7/7. A decade later, the Paris attacks seemed not to have registered. The Grenfell Tower fire last year had, however. One student tweaked the prompt successfully. When my A-level results came through, I was... They all of them remembered that. To explore this a little more, I was 10 years old when Bobby Kennedy was shot in Los Angeles in June 1968, and I wrote this verse when in an earlier workshop, along with a co-tutor of approximately my vintage, I set myself the same prompt I gave to the Tower School students. Exercise, yoke together a public event in a private context. The elders amongst us, the smiling public men, chose the Prague Spring and the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. A classroom in the 60s, grey flannel shorts, spindly arms, missing games, an illegal wireless, tuppences for the payphone, in the smelly cupboard under the stairs. This means another war. Now at last, and for once, I can astonish my father. And I added this addendum. But the young, appalled, I think, remained silent, and later checked on Wikipedia. And later, elsewhere, someone remarked, this is 2018. We are as far from 68 as 68 is from the armistice. That last truth still astonishes me. So in these circumstances, the middle-aged tutor must realign his or her worldview and timeline radically and at short notice. I wonder if that illegal wireless served to sharpen the memory. Grainy images come to mind of the whole family gathered round the set for a solemn announcement by Chamberlain, or later by Winston, or indeed the King, in the semi-gloom of drawn curtains. Those must have been unforgettable collective moments in the front room. I can't see how they would exist today, when thanks to the smartphone our news is rolling, and we are most of us tuned in to our own various media, mainstream or alternative, and who knows, already responding on Twitter. The students themselves were drawn from diverse backgrounds and communities and were reading a wide range of poets, from classical antiquity, Virgis Catullus, to the extreme contemporary, including rap performance poets. The student reading these stood up and did, or jived almost, her own tremendous performance at the group reading on the last morning. Helen Mort, Mary Jean Chan, Ocean Vuong were names that came up more than once, but it was reassuring to find that Frank O'Hara and Pablo Neruda had not entirely passed below the horizon. The same reassurance I get when my son in his early 30s tells me he's listening to Dylan or the Beatles, or even Pink Floyd. One young woman from the Pakistani community in Manchester preferred not to read out anything in public, but in the one-to-one session she did show me an impressive and angry poem that read like an act of revolt. I wanted to draw on anger also as a trigger or as a prompt, or an irritation, for example, with the now common use of hyperbolic language, the language of the corporate marketplace, or on the Airbnb platform. What did you love about X and Y when they were your guests? What do you need them to improve? Or my current pet hate, that I saw advertising a poetry course in the US of rather the kind I was giving. The tutor says in her announcement, "I am beyond excited to be giving this course in these surroundings." I might say I am looking forward, or I am apprehensive, or I am glad to be doing this. Beyond excited is not only an emotional lie, it is semantically meaningless. Poetry must surely be the counter-language to all of that. But time ran out. It will be for a future occasion. It's fascinating how a diverse group, but united in a common pursuit, can with goodwill and application meld in only 2 days into an apparently mutually supportive organism linked by affection and nascent friendship. I've even found this on the 2 occasions I've been obliged to participate in France in a sensibilisation à la sécurité routière, a 48-hour refresher course to regain some points on my driving licence. At the end, addresses were exchanged, favours promised, someone could sell me some good wine. It runs counter to the more usual narrative of human nature and is something of a balm. It was the case here, and nor should I have worried about the apparently failed prompt. It turned out to have been a challenge and a slow smoulder. A number of interesting poems emerged based on that initial exercise at the last morning round-robin reading session. And every student, of course, had her own invisible, deep sources. So combinations emerge too, from that other life we conceal from each other, and which, in Adam Phillips's words, makes our lives double. In this life, says Phillips, we are driven to always approach and avoid the objects of desire, and what makes us feel most alive makes us feel we are risking our lives. We do not know what we are doing, and yet we feel ineluctably involved in our lives. Surprise and dread are order of the day. There was surprise too and laughter, as in, he was wearing a dead mallard. She was wearing a red curtain. He said, "Do you like salmon?" She said, "But I'm gay." When we finished up with a game of consequences, thereby exorcising surrealism near to the original tree upon which sat, grinning, the Cheshire Cat.
That was Stephen Romer. You can find out more about Stephen on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 265, which was recorded by John Greening and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 266, Christy Dickerson speaks with Gabriel Badamosi about truth, writing the 16th century, and being a wild child. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.